Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. The following lecture was recorded live on Saturday, September 21st, 2013. For more information on appearances, please follow me on Twitter at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. In this discussion, we look at the three empires of North America, British, French, and Iroquois, and how they affected the outcome of the Great War for Empire. Thank you for downloading this special live edition. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Well, thank you very much to the Historical Society for having me. It's a nice way to spend a very cold and very rainy Saturday, so at least we're inside in this great room. This is a very special lecture for me for a few different reasons, because I get to talk about one of my favorite things and one of my favorite places. Of course, I'm born not far away from here, so anytime I can come into the AK Valley and speak with people who are like-minded in that way, who understand and appreciate not only the history of this region, but have their own memories and their own history here, it goes a great deal as far as that goes. But the other thing I'd like to talk about today, and this will be the crux of the lecture, is going to be about the history of not just Western Pennsylvania, but why Western Pennsylvania was so important in the grander scheme of the imperial world of the 18th century. So we kind of know the story in a general way, and maybe we can review it for a bit to start. But this is an area that was well coveted by not only the empires of Great Britain, but also the empires of France. And it wasn't by chance, it wasn't random. There were some very particular and very special reasons for this. So that's sort of what I want to discuss. But the first thing we have to do before we can really delve into how those two empires saw this area and why this area was so important is really sort of hash out who is who in the New World, why they're there, and what they mean to the larger success and the larger narrative that is the story of colonial America. We can sometimes lull ourselves into the belief, and a lot of this has to do with popular culture, that North America in the 18th century is a land of two empires, the British Empire on the eastern seaboard and the French in Canada. But if you take that view, you're going to miss out on a very critical part of the story. And when you miss out on that, the entire machinery, the cogs, the wheels just don't turn the right way. What I'll submit to you is this. North America is actually a land of three separate empires. Yes, the English. Yes, the French. But we must not discount the native peoples, because there was a native hierarchy in place, and there was a native order before the French and the British ever came around. The major Indian superpower of the time period was what we call the Iroquois Confederacy. And if you don't factor them into this story, again, as the third, maybe even shadow empire of this story, you won't really understand how it all changes from the start. Now, I have a real problem, and the fact that you're here might indicate that you have it as well, in that when I look at our modern world, everywhere around us, this room, what I see in my daily life going to work, the language I speak to you, if you're reading your program or taking notes, the language you're writing in, these are all the results of someone else's empire. Okay, when I see the world, yes, I see all the wonders of the modern day, but I see empire all around us. And again, yes, it's the language we speak, but it's also the food we eat. It's the history and culture we share. It's everywhere. So empire is one of my absolute favorite things. It's what I've dedicated my professional career to studying, and I want to talk to you a little bit about it today. The idea of empire itself is really an amazing one, because it transcends all peoples in the world. It transcends all borders in the world. Anywhere you have human beings jockeying and vying for a way of life, you have empires. You might be talking about the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia. You might be talking about the Nile River in Egypt. You might be talking about ancient Rome, or again, right here in western Pennsylvania where the three rivers meet. All of these things factor into empire. It's everywhere. As a theme, you can study it everywhere. And North America, for me, sort of stands as the great laboratory of empire. Because when you have three empires competing in one tiny space like North America, the changes you'll see are immense. And the more you look, the more you find. So let's talk a little bit about these empires, how they change the continent in the 18th century, and how they impact us today. I want to start first and foremost with the empire we probably understand the least, which is the Iroquois Confederacy, that third shadow empire we've already briefly mentioned. Because again, they do things the way empires do. Now, when we think about them, as historians, if we do study them, we don't generally call them an empire, because they never called themselves an empire. But I have a very strict rule of thumb when it comes to history. It's that if it looks like a duck, and it sounds like a duck, it's probably an empire, right? That's the idea. So what did the Iroquois do? Well, they do everything that empires do, okay? In the simplest terms, when we think of empire, we have to think of it like this. Yes, it makes your map bigger. Yes, you plant your flag in foreign lands, but empire in its simplest form is simply the spreading of your worldview, the spreading of your way of life. It's taking the way you view the world and the way you perceive the world, and it's planting it somewhere that has no similar tradition. The British will do that. We're speaking English now. The French will do that. And the Iroquois will do it as well. Now, the Iroquois Confederacy is a complicated subject because it's actually a collection of six different tribal nations who form together and work in a cooperative, in literally a confederacy. Going from west to east, this spans the entire today state of New York. There are in this area, right, trickling downward, the Seneca, there's the Cayuga. At the center is the Onondaga, that's around Syracuse, New York. There's the Oneida, the Tuscarora, and then in the far east, you have the Mohawk. Now, these are six different tribes, but they'd all consider themselves, in their origins, Iroquois, because they work together when it furthers their way of life and furthers their cause. So the Iroquois are something of an empire, and when the British and French first get to this continent, they realize very quickly, this is a group of people you have to make an official stance on. Are they going to be on your side? Or are they going to be your enemies? Because you simply can't ignore them. Now, if that went into the decision-making process for those early settlers, why should we leave it out of ours? Okay, so the Iroquois Empire is absolutely there. And one of the keys we have to get across about empire, again, whether native, British, or French, is this simple idea. Empires all want to achieve the same goals. Again, make money, become wealthy, become powerful. But they don't always get there in the same way. We'll call this maybe like perceptions of empire. Okay, the British and French are interlocked in a struggle to be the number one superpower on the planet. They both want the same things, wealth, power, prestige, influence. But as we'll see as we move on in the lecture, they get there in completely different ways. And ultimately, one will have to go, at least here in North America. But let's get back to the natives, because all empires need a few things to be successful. Number one, they need military strength. And when the Iroquois, although they're six different tribes, put their resources together, they are a force that is completely unmatched in the New World, at least, in some ways, until the Europeans arrive. So they have military strength. But all empires need a few other things. One, they need colonies, as we'll see. Colonies are the primary mechanism of growth for an empire. And two, they need subjects. Okay, we know in the American Revolutionary story, the subjects are the British, are the Americans, right? But who are the Iroquois subjects? Well, the Iroquois have their own subjects as well. And they are the people who live in this area. Some moved here by force, like the Delaware. Some who settle here, like the Shawnee. And some who are, in the simplest terms, colonists from the larger Iroquois world. They move here, they're largely Seneca, largely Cayuga. They live here for two or three generations, and they begin to call themselves Mingos. Now, collectively, the Mingo, the Shawnee, the Delaware, these are not Iroquois people. But we call them all the Ohioans, because the area where they live, the area where we are now, is the Ohio country. Now, these people, again, aren't Iroquois. They don't have the rights of the Iroquois. They don't have the benefits of the Iroquois. But they are the subjects of the Iroquois. So like all empires, they have colonies, this area. The Iroquois took it over in a brutal and bloody display in the 1640s. We call the Beaver Wars. And they have colonists as well. They have subjects as well. We'll call them the Ohioans. So after all of that, just think of it this way. There is already a pre-existing native empire in place before the English or the French ever even think about jumping into this new world. The Iroquois perception of empire is, in the simplest terms, control. They're looking for hunting grounds. That's what they'll call it. They won't say we're expanding colonies. They won't say we're conquering lands. The Iroquois say we're expanding our hunting grounds because they have a way of life. And it's a way of life that, as you'll see in my latest book, Gaya Sutta, it's a life that is slowly but surely falling away. Now, I bring up the figure of Gaya Sutta for a few reasons. Again, he's a very important, influential chief in the region, but he also does something that all of us are going to experience today in a way that's completely unknown to him. And it's that he will experience all three of these empires throughout his life, and he deals with them on a personal basis. He's a major political figure in the Iroquois world. And in the first part of his life, he deals exclusively with the Empire of France. He sees the French worldview, and he sees how the French want to insert themselves on this continent. Later in life, in his Middle Ages, he'll deal with the British on a regular basis. He sees that along the way. And throughout his entire life, he also sees his own Iroquois imperial vision. But unfortunately for him, as you'll see in the book, that vision collapses more and more, piece by piece, as he goes on in his life, until there's nothing of it left. So we have to put these native peoples first on the continent to have a better idea of who they are and what they represent and what they're doing here, because in every sense of the word, they are an empire. And empires, by their very existence, do their best when they're competing. We don't think of them as a competitive empire. We leave that to the British and French. But they very much are competing in this world for many of the same reasons. Now, let's get back to the story maybe we're a little more familiar with. That is the European perception of empire. Because even in that, it's a very different perception of empire. You're talking about two very different perceptions of empire. The first European people in the New World, and this is going back, we'll say are the Spanish. Right? The Treaty of Tordesillas in the 16th century sort of makes the determination by Pope Alexander VI that the Spanish can have everything in the Western Hemisphere, right? It's good for them, I suppose. But the fact of the matter is, the British and French won't even enter this world, really for 100 years. So when the Spanish get here, they find incredible wealth and incredible fortune because they're expanding their empire. And they build what amounts to the largest Western empire in world history to that point. New Spain, that's Central and South America, will be 10 times the size of the original Spain itself. And they find something in these new colonies that's really incredible, because they literally pull money, gold and silver, out of the ground themselves. Incredible riches in the new world they'll find. They're not harvesting some exotic crop. They're not bringing in some unique, plant or fur that makes money back in Europe. They're literally pulling gold and silver out of the ground. And if you're England and you're France, and you know that empire is a competitive world, for every day you're not in the New World, you're losing to the Spanish. That's the idea. So when the French, we'll go with them first arrive, they'll land in Canada. And the man who leads them there is named Jacques Cartier. And when Jacques Cartier is exploring the New World, he's looking for, in his mind, what empire looks like in the day. That's lots of gold and lots of silver as quick and as sometimes painfully as possible to get. Because that's what the Spanish do. And he'll consider himself, for all of the 16th century, a failure, because he's not finding that gold and silver. He's also not finding what he calls the Northwest Passage, which is a waterway to China, which you're not going to find in Canada, incidentally. So he views the early French experience in the New World as a failure for that reason, but it's not. There is a fortune to be made in North America, but it's not found in the way that he's looking. Again, when ideas change, when perceptions change, That's when you see real historical change emerge. And for Jacques Cartier, he's viewing the North American landscape in a very Spanish way, in a very, even maybe you can say, Pacific way. Because all the rich markets are not in the Atlantic Ocean, they're in China, and they're in India. And to find a faster way to the Pacific Ocean, that's what he's looking for as well. If only he could have changed his perception of things, he would have seen that there was a great deal of capital to be gained by exploring North America, just in a different way. But France will put aside its ambitions for North America for about 20 years, until 1608, when a man named Samuel de Champlain arrives and founds what we think of as Quebec. And when he does it, he sees an incredible thing. It's that Cartier was right. There is no gold and silver in North America. So the formula the Spanish used to become wealthy and powerful, the most powerful empire in Europe, isn't going to work. But there is a fortune to be made elsewhere. And he sees it in the natural resources themselves. He says to himself, what don't we have in Europe, okay, that we need that's here in abundance in North America? Well, he sees endless amounts of timber. Okay, this is Canada we're talking about. And he sees incredible amounts of animals with furs that can be harvested for wealth. Again, these are the things you don't find in Europe anymore. Because Europe's been habitated for about, 5,000 years, at least to that point. And we've cut down the trees and we've skinned the animals and populations dwindle. But North America, it's a cash cow. That's the idea. Now, how rich are furs? Because we're going to talk about animal furs. Samuel de Champlain will begin to acquire furs from the native peoples for about a rate of 3 French livres. He'll sell them back in Europe. What he bought for 3 French livres for over 200. Now, you don't have to know conversion rates to understand that's a major, serious profit margin. And yeah, it's not gold and silver, but it can be if you use it in the right ways. So that's the idea. Empire, in a lot of ways, is about how you manage your expectations and how you view the world. And when the French arrive in Canada, in North America, it's their worldview that's going to be spread based on, interestingly enough, a changing idea. Okay, so the French have their first great colony of Quebec. Samuel de Champlain is engaging in the fur trade. Things are going very well for New France. That's what they call the area, New France. So we're dealing with empires in competition. Again, over and over again, we're going to say that. Empires in competition. What's the reason? Why? How's it there? What does it look like? And you have to be careful when you talk about empires in competition. Because again, not every empire is the same. They want to do the same things as far as their goal, but they don't always go about getting them in the same way. So I'll give you one statement that's really mind-blowing and seems very one-sided as we talk about it, that I promise you won't be with further exploration. By the time the English colonies reach the Appalachian Mountains, if you can visualize this, the Empire of New France has already touched the Rocky Mountains. Okay, now think of that. If you ever look at a map of colonial America, you see this incredible disparity in the size of these empires. England is huddled very closely along the Atlantic seaboard, but New France stretches for hundreds, if not thousands of miles. Okay, that's the idea. Now, it seems like the French are running away with whatever the competitive world North America is. But the issue is they really aren't. They aren't at all, in fact. Because their perceptions of empire, what an empire should look like, what an empire should sound like, what an empire should smell like, it's all very different than what the English have. So why do the French stretch so far to the Rocky Mountains when the English have just barely begun to cross the Appalachians? It goes like this. It's the way the French want to build their empires. All empires have one job. Okay? And again, it's what makes this region where we live so important. All empires have one job. It's to make money. All colonies have one job, and it's to make money for the empire itself, the empire back home, whether it be in England or in France. A colony, in the simplest term, is an investment. The empire is going to put money into it, it's going to put troops, it's going to build forts, it's going to establish settlements and ways of life, and the reason you invest anything is to get a return, right, to get money back. So if the colony doesn't produce money back to the empire, it's going to be a failed venture. Think, like for the English, the lost colony of Roanoke, right? They produce nothing and they disappear. So for the Spanish, what did the colonies produce? They produced gold and silver. I mean, all they had to do was dig it up and turn it into a coin. It's that simple. The Spanish imperial economy will increase by 25% from what they find there. But in the New World, Again, France, what does it have to contribute? Well, it contributes natural resources like fur, like timber, and like fish. So France has the idea of building its empire in this way. They don't really care about controlling the land. Okay, think of that. They don't necessarily care about controlling the land because land isn't where the value is. The value is in the trade goods they get from the native peoples, the fur and the timber. So when New France builds an empire, for them it's about controlling water. Not land, but water. In New France, they view North America like the human body. Okay, at the center is the heart. For them, that's the St. Lawrence River Valley, Quebec, Montreal. And because that's the heart, right, well, how does the heart communicate with the rest of the body? Well, it uses veins to go all over the body. Well, for them, the veins of the body are the rivers and lakes of North America. So for them, they figure, if we can put people in canoes and send them down rivers, down the St. Lawrence, into the Great Lakes, down the Mississippi, you can effectively explore all of this land without ever really having to leave your boat. Okay? So what they're doing is going to places Europeans have never been before, as far as the Rocky Mountains. But they're not establishing and settling the land. They're not interested in doing that, though. So you could see how a region with not one, not two, but three rivers, like ours, would be very important in that larger perspective. Okay, because again, all of these rivers connect to everything. You could go from Fort Duquesne, which they'll build just down the Allegheny here, where the Allegheny, the Monongahela, form the Ohio, and you could be back to Montreal just in a few weeks, never having to leave your ship, effectively. You'd go up the Allegheny, through French Creek into Lake Erie, through the Niagara River, through Lake Ontario, and then you're back in the St. Lawrence. So that's the idea. All of their empires connected through water. But you're not going to see them building cities and building towns. It just doesn't happen that way. Because they don't value the land. They value how far the water can take them and how it reconnects back to everything else. It's why, again, Fort Duquesne, where three rivers meet, is going to be important. That's how they fortified. They built tiny, tiny forts at anywhere major river crossings came together. So that was how New France became so big and so enormous. But to say that New France controlled that area was very ineffective. Because the fact of the matter is, by the time we get to the 1750s when France and Britain will collide, the entire population of New France is probably less than what you'd find in Hinds Field on any given Sunday. 60,000 people? Maybe that's it. For all of that territory. So it's an immense imperial project, but it's misleading to say it's really that big. The French are traveling there, but they're not staying there. The English have a very different view of empire. And it's a much slower growing form of empire, but it's a much more permanent form of empire. And it's why I believe that when they compete in what we call the French and Indian War for control of this continent, it gives the English a decided advantage. The English perception of empire is this. They're going to start on the Atlantic Ocean, visualize Boston, Philadelphia, Charleston, New York City, and little by little, they're going to move westward. They're going to clear a square inch of land, clear a square foot of land, clear a square mile of land. And when they clear that, they're going to settle it. So while the French have what we think of as a circulatory system version of an empire, get as far as you can, as fast as you can, with no real value in holding the land, the English have what we call a clear and hold strategy of empire. They might grow very slowly, but when they do grow, they're there permanently. So for every square acre of forest an English family will eliminate, they're going to settle right away. So they'll never lose that land. So when we say the English will only get to the Appalachian Mountains by the time the French get to the Rocky Mountains, yes, it does sound like France has a decided advantage. But they really don't, because they're growing in different ways, in different forms, all trying to get to the same place. The English will get to the Appalachian Mountains by the 1750s, and that land is permanently theirs. There's no question that it's not going to be taken from them. But the French, by that point, have a much bigger, expansive version of empire, but it's not the same empire necessarily. So why are the three rivers for us so important? Well, as you can imagine, the English are growing very slowly from the coast. The French are using all these waterways for decades. Eventually, that English world is going to expand into the world of the French, right? And the place they expand is here, the land of the three rivers, what we call the Ohio Country. The English and French will both have rival claims to the region because individuals like Lawrence Washington and the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, Robert Dinwiddie, We'll begin investing in land in this area, land we're probably standing on now, to buy and sell. Remember, the English, it's all about gobbling up land. And the French view it as an affront to their system. Again, their interconnected web of lakes and rivers that connect everything back to the heart of New France that you'd see in the St. Lawrence River Valley. But that's what we'll see, and that's where I focus most of my work in my books, is the Seven Years' War and the American Revolution, because it's a very tumultuous world for that reason. The English will have something like over 1 million people by the time the French and Indian War starts. And again, the French have less than 75,000. Right? So how competitive is that world really? Well, if you create all things being equal, okay, it's a very competitive world. But from what we've talked about already, versions of empire, it's really not that competitive after all. So these differing perceptions of empire do determine the larger foreign policy of these empires of the 18th century. There's no question they do. But it's amazing how still to this day, even based on where we live, they also give such an identity and such a purpose to the place we live today. Thanks. Okay, this is all. Now, that was, you know, the beginning. It's always better when there's questions. That's always where the good stuff comes out. And think of it more of a discussion. Are there any questions? Yeah. Okay. That's the last chapter of my book on Guy Suden. It's very interesting. Because if you go to Sharpsburg today, there is an enormous statue of this very young, very fit warrior, Gayasutta. I mean, Gayasutta has no less than 4 enormous likenesses, whether they be statues or murals, all over Pittsburgh. But very few people know about him. He did have what they called a plantation. And we're talking about a man in his 60s and 70s in what is today Sharpsburg. He lived there with a few of his wives. That's the idea. But we don't really know if O'Hara owned the land at the same time. Because we know that he probably dies along French Creek on the grant given to his nephew, Corn Planter, whose painting, incidentally, is around the corner outside. That's what, again, from my vantage point, that's the best evidence I've found. But O'Hara will own that land later. So do they live together? Maybe there's a brief overlap, but it's nothing that changes through the larger story, I guess. Okay. Other questions? Well, the native world is a very divided place. And again, if there's a hierarchy, that means there's always a struggle. The 6 nations of the Iroquois never really fought one another because they realized that together as a confederacy, again, they're with each other when it serves them, they were almost unstoppable in the new world. I mean, they were an amazingly incredible force. So they didn't fight one another. But remember we talked about their subjects, the Delaware, the Shawnee, the Mingo, the non-Iroquois people who lived here. They absolutely went to war with the Iroquois. And that's really what plays into the larger French and Indian War, because the Iroquois are British allies. It's a long-standing agreement they call the Covenant Chain. But the French also realize they'll never be competitive if they don't have an Indian ally. So if they can't have the Iroquois on their side, who are they going to have? Well, the French will begin to woo the Ohioans, the Iroquois subjects, to their side. So when we think of it as, well, the British are teamed with the Iroquois and the French are teamed with the Iroquois subjects, it's sort of misleading, and that's what a lot of hit on in the Gayasutta book, is for the Ohioans, this is their rebellion against the Iroquois. The French are just giving them weapons and supplies, and if the French win, so be it. They don't really care about the French victory. For them, if the British win, the Iroquois win, they stay subjects. If the French win, they're a free people. So that's what you see. Yeah, there absolutely was a lot of very deep struggle between the native peoples themselves. If you were to say a Wyandot, right? If you were a Shawnee, at least early on when Europeans arrived, you would view each other as separate nations. You would view each other as different as the British and French view each other. In fact, you would view each other as different as you, a Shawnee, and the British. There was no sense yet that we are all Indians and they are all Europeans. I mean, that makes sense to us. We live in a very racialized world today, where we like to divide people by ethnicities and race. But in their world, again, 2 Indian tribes were just as different, again, early on, as an Indian and a European group. That really doesn't start to emerge until after the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, which is really 150 years after the first European colonization. So, again, it's getting into the Indian mindset, something I really wanted to do in the Gaya Sutta book. Yes, Steve. Tanacharison, Tanagrison, Tanacharison. We have a lot of different names for him. This is because Indians had no written language. So what we have is sort of white people trying to spell out what they're saying in a lot of ways. But Tanacharison was what we called a half-king, which meant, again, the Iroquois controlled the Ohio country where we are, but they didn't necessarily live here. So what they would do is just accept that these people are their subjects, and they'd send out these viceroys, or these local administrators called half-kings, into the region to keep things under control. Tanacharison is part of the old Iroquois order, and he lives here. And in the last years of his life, you'll see him, if you, for example, purchase my book on George Washington, you'll see Tanacharison and Washington interacting very early on, when Washington's very young, before the French and Indian War starts. And Tanacharison is very worried, because he lives in the Ohio country, and he sees, again, he's an old Iroquois purist, that the French are trying to get their subjects to rebel against them. And Tanacharison is trying to tell the people back in Iroquois, back in New York, listen, we're not as in control as we think. These young warriors are starting to rebel. And if they side with France, they will rebel. So he's sort of kind of shaking his fist at the rain in that way, because they are going to rebel. He sees it, but he can't stop it. Now, he'll die in 1754, 1 year after we first see him in the record of Washington. But the last years of his life are spent trying to bring the Iroquois subjects back under control, and he knows he can't do it. But he is old Iroquois all the way. He's a very conservative believer in the old empire, right? That's what we'd say. Okay. Anything else? This is, you know, one of the things about empire I love is that they're great catalysts of change. That is, when they come into an area, people get opportunities, get new chances they never had before. So in this area, what we're going to see is, particularly the Allegheny River Valley, especially, is that this is the home of what a group we call the Western Delaware. Okay, now I just told you the Indian world's very subdivided. Here's the Delaware. You guys like just got a hold of that, right? And now there's this subdivision of the Delaware, the Western Delaware and the Eastern Delaware. Well, the Eastern Delaware are English allies. They live farther east in like Harrisburg. They deal with the English people all the time. They know them. They know they can coexist peacefully. But the Western Delaware, the Delaware who live in this region, they're more inclined to side with rebellion against the Iroquois because the French are giving them weapons and supplies and alcohol and ammunition, and the English aren't. So these areas here, all the way basically from probably the area we'd be here, to especially Katanning. Katanning was an enormous Western Delaware village. And during the French and Indian War, when the Western Delaware joined with the French and really began terrorizing this landscape, people kind of think of Katanning as like the heart of darkness, right, in the Indian world. This is where the real troublemakers live. And if you were anybody, a who's who in the Delaware world, and you were against the Iroquois and therefore against the British, you would be in Katanning. But all along here, Freeport, Fort City, and going to the major city of Katanning, this was Western Delaware land. It was the heart of the rebellion against the Iroquois. So it's a very important region. But again, it takes a general understanding of the three empires I've mentioned to really see where this comes into play. Otherwise, the story just won't make sense. Okay. Anything else? Well, I look, yeah, go ahead. Okay. I haven't come up with them necessarily, but I can say this in a generality that may or may not answer your question. The Ohio country was populated with really three other groups before Europeans arrived. They're the Erie, the Susquehannocks. These are the groups. They may have been part of that. But remember I said that the Iroquois first gained this land, again, this western PA, the state of Ohio, the Ohio country, through what we call the Beaver Wars. And what the Beaver Wars were really the Iroquois trying to get this land because there's a lot of money to be made from France buying the furs. So they literally exterminated all the people who lived here in the 1640s. They may have been part of that. I mean, it was a genocide of a horrifying figure that the Iroquois did. So I would be willing to guess that because after the Beaver Wars, after 1650, you know, the Iroquois are in control, but the way they choose to do it is by killing everyone who lives here. And it's really probably one of the single bloodiest spells of history we have, but we don't know the figures. But we know all of those people were completely wiped out. Right. And again, that's very imperial, right? It sort of reeks of imperialism when you think. Okay. Well, you know, I'll be at the table. If I look forward to hearing your research, what you're working on, what you're dealing with, just talking about the subject, anything. You know, I'm here. I have nowhere to be. So thank you very much again, and I look forward to meeting you.